KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, now that the Federal Communications Commission has voted to repeal net neutrality rules, what happens next? How will lifting the requirement that internet providers treat all internet traffic equally change your online experience? And will it even happen here? State and local lawmakers are vowing to fight back.
In January, when the California legislature goes back in session, I'm going to introduce legislation to adopt net neutrality as a requirement in California.
We look at the impact of yesterday's decision to end open internet rules. Next on Forum, join us. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Reaction in the Bay Area to the FCC's decision to end net neutrality rules has been swift and pretty negative. Santa Clara's County Council James Williams vowed to sue the Federal Communications Commission yesterday.
The reversal of net neutrality is arbitrary and unjustified, and it is therefore unlawful. Santa Clara County is not going to let the FCC's action stand.
In a party line vote, the Republican majority of the FCC ended the rules that prohibit internet service providers like Verizon or Comcast from giving preferential treatment to some content while slowing or blocking others. FCC Chair Ajit Pai said net neutrality rules hurt investment and innovation in broadband infrastructure. But some Democratic lawmakers are furious. And we go to one now, Silicon Valley Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, who is ranking member of the Communications and Technology Subcommittee. Good morning, Congresswoman Eshoo.
Good morning. Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Well, we're glad to have you. You are upset about the FCC's decision. Tell us why.
Well, this is yesterday, I think, was a very sad day for people across our country because the internet, as we know it, has been accessible and open to everyone. So this is a dramatic shift, a dramatic change. People today pay their internet service provider, either AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, Charter, for their service. But then they are free to access all legal content the way they want. They can go where they want. They can read what they want. They can apply apps as they wish. And what the FCC did yesterday was to turn over all of that to these giant service providers. Again, the companies that I just mentioned. So they will have total control of the internet, and that is a dramatic shift.
And
what was also included in yesterday's order was that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, will no longer be the cop on the beat. They're turning over the entirety of this issue to the Federal Trade Commission, which to the average person sounds like a so what. But the FTC is the Trade Commission. Is neither the agency of knowledge relative to communications, but it can only protect an individual, if you want to call it protection, once something has gone wrong. I don't think any one of my constituents or anyone in the country can stand up to a federal agency. So there really is there's an abandonment of enforcement as well.
Well, Congresswoman Eshoo, Congress does have the power to stop the FCC under the Congressional Review Act. It could overrule the FCC's decision. Ed Markey is introducing a Congressional Review Act resolution. From your vantage point, does this have any chance?
I'm sorry to say no, because the Republican Congress has supported what the chairman has wanted to do when he was a commissioner, as well as right now. But we will push the issue. I will be part of that congressional Review Act resolution of disapproval as soon as the order hits the Federal Register. It is in the court of public opinion. This is a total loser. There isn't any person in the country that really supports this. There are four companies that are gleeful about it, and it ends there. So where this will go is to litigation. And it's very important to note that the net neutrality rules that were in place and stripped away yesterday were approved by the court when the ISPs sued. And so I think that we have good standing in the federal court. And, of course, there are many across the country in terms of attorneys general and others that are jumping in to sue as well. But the I don't believe that there's a chance in Congress to reinstate net neutrality rules, and that's been apparent to me for a long time.
So then for people, you mentioned how this is so unpopular in the court of public opinion. For people who are angry about the FCC's decision, what do you suggest they do?
Well, tens of millions of Americans weighed in at the FCC. In fact, it broke all records for the American people weighing in with a federal agency. There have never been that many people that have weighed in the history of the country. So when I say in the court of public opinion, the country, regardless of how people are registered to vote, they are opposed to this. I think that the case will be litigated, and I think that we have good standing in the court. And certainly people can still weigh in with the FCC. The comment period is over, but they can still weigh in and call the FCC and tell them what they think.
Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, she represents California's 18th district, which includes parts of San Mateo, Santa Clara, and Santa Cruz counties. Thanks for talking with us this morning.
Thank you for having me on, and blessed holidays to everyone.
You too. And let me tell you who else is joining us for the hour. April Glazer is a technology writer for Slate. Good morning, April Glazer.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. We're also joined by Brian Fung. He's technology writer for The Washington Post. Good morning, Brian Fung.
Good morning.
April Glazer, I'll start with you. So let's back up a little bit. For people who support net neutrality, what are the practical impacts of its repeal that they're most concerned about?
People are concerned that the way they use the internet is going to drastically change, because without net neutrality, ISPs like Comcast or Verizon or AT&T will be able to block websites or charge websites a fee to access them. And all they need to do in order to do this is say they reserve the right to do so. But that means that, for instance, if you have a favorite local restaurant that has a menu that you like, or a hair salon you go to that that has a website and this is all online, they might find that their sites load a lot slower because they can't afford that priority access. So instead, they might migrate over to Yelp. And the internet might become like a very boring place because all of this diversity where there are just, you know, tons of websites and tons of locations where people could kind of set up their own shops is now being consolidated because Yelp can afford that fast access and they see their traffic drop on their own sites.
And so if you there's been some concern that it could look like future internet access could look like a mobile phone plan where you have to pay for certain levels of access to certain websites or other benefits like that.
Yeah, one of the big concerns, particularly with mobile, is that it might start to look like cable TV, where, you know, you pay for HBO and Showtime. You might actually pay for Facebook or Twitter. It's not that you won't get full access to the internet, but let's say once your data dries up, you can then buy a plan that gives you free access to just a bundle of social media sites or a bundle of video streaming sites. And the truth is that those who get to pick what sites are in the in that bundle, rather, are the phone companies, are the telecoms, and they'll get to choose who wins and who loses. And you know, if you're a big social media addict, you might opt for this plan. But, you know, having access to Facebook isn't the same as being able to research something or, you know, get a lot of different news websites available to you. It's a very different internet experience.
Well, Brian Fung, hasn't this already been happening in some ways, though, where AT&T, Verizon, they've been kind of allowing consumers to access some of their services a little more easily than others?
Well, this is sort of gets to one of the core issues of the net neutrality debate, where internet providers say, oh, we're offering innovative new services to consumers. Consumer advocates say, yes, but those offerings stand to affect competition potentially in ways that ultimately harm consumers. And so this is all about sort of how these offerings get presented to people as, you know, potentially a great thing, but have hidden consequences that may ultimately wind up, you know, damaging the internet ecosystem in the end.
Well, what have ISPs been saying about people's concerns that they could, you know, throttle or slow some websites and prioritize other kinds of content, speed that up, that kind of a thing, that it could become more of like a pay-to-play kind of situation for businesses?
Well, internet providers have basically said your daily internet experience isn't going to change next year, next month, or and this is something that they've said for a long time, which is that they're in theory in favor of net neutrality, that they simply oppose the FCC's attempt to implement it with these specific rules. Now, there's obviously a lot of wiggle room there for internet providers to say that they support net neutrality in principle, but then in practice, you know, that could mean still charging websites or slowing certain websites just so long as they, you know, disclose the fact. So there's, you know, these internet providers essentially have been supporting a weaker form of the rules for years and years and years, and this is simply sort of the latest step in that effort.
Well, April Glazer, what was the FCC's rationale for lifting the rules in the first place? What was Ajit Pai saying when he said that it would, you know, that the rules in the past hurt broadband investment and innovation?
Yeah, he was claiming that, you know, the rules de-incentivized ISPs from building out their networks, and that the real problem isn't that, you know, Comcast or Verizon might slow down access to a particular website they don't like or anything like that. But the real problem is that, you know, millions of Americans still don't have access to a reliable broadband connection. And while that's true, that is a huge problem, those two things aren't necessarily like, you know, cause and effect with one another. And the other thing is that although he claims that it's disincentivized investment in their networks, after the 2015 rules were passed, I went back and listened to all the investor calls for Comcast and AT&T and Verizon, and they all said that they had been investing more in their networks. And they all said that they had been expanding their offerings and that they had been building out more. And so his claim doesn't really quite jibe with what, you know, these ISPs are telling their investors. He's citing research from you know, trade groups, but not necessarily from the ISPs themselves.
Brian Fung, is that your understanding as well, that really there has been a very good level of investment from these internet service providers in their broadband infrastructure?
Well, this is a debate that's become very heavily politicized, and the studies on the subject that try and show either a decrease in broadband investment or an increase they all come from interested parties. So it makes it very difficult to actually tell, you know, who is telling the truth here. I think that there is the data do appear to show that broadband investment has, you know, the pace of broadband investment has declined a little bit, but whether or not that's the cause of the net neutrality rules or due to something else, you know, business plans by providers that were already in effect and moving forward is less clear. So you can nevertheless expect this issue of broadband investment to come up in any litigation that happens on net neutrality. And you'll expect the FCC to make a strong case or at least as strong a case as it can, that this market had changed significantly to the point where the FCC really needed to roll these rules back.
And we're talking with Brian Fung, technology reporter for The Washington Post, and also April Glazer, technology writer for Slate. Earlier, we were joined by Congresswoman Anna Eshoo. And Brian Fung, one of the points that she raised is that that the FTC now has the power to protect consumers from abuses, but she's concerned that they don't have maybe the knowledge or the resources to be able to do this effectively. What's your take? Because this has been a big part of Ajit Pai's argument as to why the FCC can let go of net neutrality rules.
So one big concern here is that the Federal Trade Commission is not technically an expert agency. It's got very smart people and a lot of really talented technologists, but the traditional role of the Federal Communications Commission has been to focus on networks and communications. So to move the jurisdiction or the enforcement authority from the FCC to the FTC, a lot of folks think will actually weaken the government's ability to prosecute or to punish alleged violations of net neutrality. And, you know, beyond all of that, you have this question of whether after-the-fact enforcement really helps people when you're talking about both companies that could be, you know, could essentially rise and fall or go bankrupt in the amount of time it could take to prosecute an FTC case, assuming the FTC even takes up a case against an internet provider. And then secondly, you know, while that litigation may be moving forward, you know, consumers could be suffering at the hands of an alleged internet provider that's allegedly abusing the net neutrality sort of principle.
Well, can you talk about the relationship of the pending Ninth Circuit case between the FTC and AT&T Mobility, its relationship to what we're talking about right now?
Sure. So in order to understand what's really going on here, you have to talk a little bit about the FTC's powers that Congress gave it and how it relates to the Federal Communications Commission's set of powers. Right now, the FTC is generally empowered to go after companies that engage in allegedly misleading or deceptive or unfair behavior. So that includes, you know, if a company were to essentially lie to its customers saying we're going to do one thing but then do something else. But where that power stops is with a category of companies called common carriers. And a common carrier essentially is a fancy term to describe things like telecom companies, railroads, airlines to some extent, cruise lines, oil and gas pipelines, essentially companies that are supposed to carry stuff from one place to another without discriminating as to its content. Now, when the FTC is, the FTC isn't allowed to go after common carriers because that's historically been the job of the FCC. And so this whole Ninth Circuit case is about whether or not this common carrier exemption at the FTC is going to be something that a lot more companies will try and take advantage of in the future years based on whether or not a company happens to own a telecom company.
I see, and hence the reason that there's so much concern about the FTC's ability to prosecute companies like AT&T. We've heard a lot, April Glazer, about the not just the impact on the individual user, but also concerns about the impact of net neutrality's repeal on small businesses. Can you just talk briefly about what that concern is?
Sure. So, you know, the issue with net neutrality is that ISPs can charge websites a fee to access users, but those who can or access users at faster speeds, rather, but those who will be setting the price for those fast lanes will probably be the large incumbent companies like Google or Netflix. And they'll maybe be able to pay a price that the smaller companies won't be able to afford. And, you know, in effect, when that not being able to afford that fast lane service might mean that, you know, their websites load a lot slower. And, you know, let's face it, when a website loads slower, you open a new tab and go to the other one, right? And you go to the one that loads faster. And it's kind of a, it's not censorship per se, but in a way, it kind of diverts people's attention to the faster loading website and makes it much harder for those smaller businesses to get any attention or for their goods to be sold. And it might make it less appealing to investors who are looking to invest in small businesses or new upstarts. And that's a big deal here in Silicon Valley, where we have so many people trying to start new internet businesses. You know, if right off the bat they're not at a level playing field or are going to be disadvantaged in such a massive way, you know, investors might be dissuaded from putting their money into those ventures.
Well, we have on the line with us now Chris Kelly. He's chairman of Fandor, a San Francisco-based online movie streaming site. And previously he was general counsel at Facebook. Good morning, Chris Kelly.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for being here. So talk about your concerns around the net neutrality repeal, as I understand you have had them for quite some time.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been engaged in this issue since I joined Facebook in 2005. And, you know, at that time, Facebook had to depend very heavily on, you know, easy access. And the fights that we had with first with college, you know, various college campuses, and then later on with a variety of telecom providers told me that my experience was that net neutrality was a critical part of the future. And then, you know, even though Facebook ended up growing, as did Netflix and a number of other players, into the type of businesses that might be able to do the business development deals with large telecom carriers that will allow it to survive in a non-net neutrality world, we believed deeply then, I believe deeply now, in innovation and the importance of protecting the internet economy. And this is a major threat to it.
Well, as an indie movie streaming company, what are you concerned that ISPs could do to what you're trying to achieve?
If there's a preference for HBO or Showtime on AT&T services, or for, you know, Universal Movies on Comcast services, or for, you know, Fox Movies on Disney's new streaming service, then that is inherently disadvantageous to companies like ours that are trying to build a, you know, better future of content for the users of the internet.
Well, we have a comment from Alex, one of our listeners, who writes, could large web companies like Facebook, Google, or Wikipedia fight this new policy? Do you think Silicon Valley companies could do an end run around this somehow?
Well, I do hold out some hope for it, and at this point I would encourage it. After having the battle that we've had over, you know, enshrining net neutrality in law and a major win at the end of the Obama administration, and you know, there's still some hope here given how, you know, borderline corrupt the process was, that Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has proven that there was massive identity theft in the public comments that were part of this move by the FCC. And, you know, I think that's one of the issues that's going to be litigated out, you know, at a time when, you know, Russian bots are running throughout America on the Internet. That's just something that we should be deeply concerned about. But I do think that it's time for a variety of the Valley companies who have been deep believers in net neutrality to look at other options to make sure that they can reach end users of the Internet.
Chris Kelly, chairman of Fandor, San Francisco-based online movie streaming site. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And let me also thank Alex for the comment and invite other listeners to join the conversation. We're looking at the repeal of net neutrality and what it could mean for consumers and companies. Join the conversation by calling us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or post comments on Twitter or Facebook. What questions do you have about how the repeal of net neutrality will play out? Or are you in favor of repeal? Or at least don't think it's all doom and gloom out there. Join us after the break. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're looking at what the repeal of net neutrality could mean for users of the internet and for companies now that internet service providers no longer have to treat all internet content equally. Supporters of the change say the move will fuel greater innovation and new investments by broadband service providers. But critics worry that deregulation will basically convert the web into a pay-to-play type situation when it comes to accessing certain websites and so on. And we're joined this hour by April Glazer. She's a technology writer for Slate, and Brian Fung, a technology reporter for The Washington Post. And we're joined by you, our listeners, who are writing and calling in. We'll start with Ben, who writes, these rules were put in place in 2015. Somehow the internet made it okay for 25 years without it. The repeal of these rules will just make people move those services that don't engage in throttling. We, the consumer, just need to pay more attention. Your thoughts on that, April Glazer?
Well, it's not exactly true that, you know, 2015 was the first instance of net neutrality rules in the United States. There were also net neutrality rules in 2010, and that's what was challenged in 2014 that led to the codifying of the 2015 rules. And those 2010 rules were used to slap companies on the wrist that acted in non-neutral ways. And the FCC, even before those 2010 rules, also did, you know, punish companies that violated the principle of network neutrality. So to say that, you know, we were fine before and we'll be fine now and customers should just vote with their wallet isn't necessarily the case.
Well, Bill writes, the FCC decision is just the latest example of corporate America taking the reins of democracy from all Americans. Any litigation will pass through Trump-appointed judges. This is a travesty. Brian Fung, so we've heard now that there will be litigation. And, you know, I think Eric Schneiderman is the first out of the gate to do this. And what will the main argument be that the FCC violated?
Well, you know, there are going to be a couple of arguments on the table here. One is probably that the FCC violated the Administrative Procedures Act, essentially an argument that the FCC didn't show its work, that the FCC comment process that was designed to solicit public feedback on the plan before it was voted on was flawed. And then you'll also probably get the folks arguing that the FCC rules are simply, you know, infeasible and unworkable, you know, and that the agency should be, you know, should have to roll them back. You'll see folks trying to argue for an injunction ahead of probably any formal court appearance. And then finally, if I could just weigh in here on this argument about, you know, the internet having flourished under, you know, a relatively light touch regime before. You know, in 1996, the internet looked very different. You had, Facebook wasn't around, Netflix wasn't around. You didn't have companies like Uber or, you know, large businesses like AT&T trying to buy up content companies. And so the question here is whether or not the internet as it was can still survive in a world where internet providers like Comcast and AT&T are increasingly becoming increasingly powerful by buying up media companies, by buying up content, and then having the power to control access to that content to you know, millions of consumers.
Well, April Glazer, let's break down some of what Brian Fung was saying. And earlier, he also said that there were concerns that the public comment process was flawed. I mean, what do we mean by flawed? We heard that there were potentially thousands of fake comments that flooded this public comment period.
Millions, according to the Attorney General of New York, actually. There have been some serious irregularities that have unfolded in the process to Pai's repeal that was finalized yesterday, including, you know, a handful of people who apparently had posted comments posthumously, people who were dead that were on the register. You know, stolen identities were used. As I mentioned, the New York Attorney General said he found over 2 million stolen identities were used to publish comments. There were close to 500,000 comments that were mostly from Russian email addresses, you know, and that's suspicious in this political environment. You know, and then there was also a cyber attack that was on the FCC's comment system that is still currently under investigation by the Government Accountability Office. All of these things, this constellation of huge snafus, makes a pretty good case that the public comment process has been so flawed that, you know, it's time to pull the brakes and give people a fair shot to weigh in.
And the other point that Brian made was about the likelihood that the new rules would take effect while it's being challenged in court. Do you think that a judge would allow them to go forward even as it's being litigated?
Sure. Now, just because a lawsuit is presented, that doesn't mean that an injunction is going to be granted. And that would mean that these ISPs can continue to act in discriminatory ways, or they can go ahead with their pay-for-play plans. But yes, they will be challenged in court. But just because they're challenged in court doesn't mean that, you know, they're going to have to stop and be tied up and won't be able to institute their new pay-for-play models.
Well, let's now go to the phones. Howard in Castro Valley. Hi, Howard.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. There's been a lot of focus on speed and the fast lane and the quantitative difference that might occur. But I thought maybe we should broaden the discussion to the qualitative differences that could also happen. For example, some of the emerging tech with regard to remote sensing, telemedicine, IoT technology, where the quality of the service is even more important than how much bandwidth it's provided. So not just streaming, but, for example, if you're operating surgically remotely, you need a higher QoS, quality of service, that could be assured by a better, quote-unquote, connection. So there's a lot of things that could be impacted, not just the speed of your movie.
Yes, April Glazer, you're nodding.
Yes. You know, there are, as more and more of our lives are ported onto the Internet, you know, and we are... You know, surgeons are working with each other through remote places online, and, you know, hospitals rely on the Internet in order to be sure that they're getting the proper care to people. It becomes increasingly important that they have a reliable, fast connection. And, you know, somehow bottlenecking them by charging them more to get that connection could throw a lot of wrenches in the gears in terms of, you know, innovative progress in all kinds of spaces.
Well, Philip writes, my initial reaction to this decision is shock. However, most aspects of our capitalist society operate in a non-neutral playing field. How is this any different? And Charles tweets, I only have one option for high-speed internet. If Comcast decides to charge extra for Netflix, there's nothing I can do. How can we get more competition in internet access? Brian Fung, isn't that what the FCC was saying, that by lifting the net neutrality rules to some degree, it would stimulate competition?
That's right. In theory, you know, in a world where you had lots of broadband competition, you wouldn't really need net neutrality rules because, you know, consumers could just switch to a broadband provider who did obey those principles. But the fact that many consumers lack broadband choices means that there are only a handful of companies in each market who could, you know, essentially collude without actually, you know, taking the steps to meet in a smoke-filled room to act in ways that would not benefit consumers. And so that's why the FCC went forward and approved these regulations back in 2015.
Well, let's hear next from Jody in Vallejo. Hi, Jody.
Hi. This has been a great conversation. Got me thinking about a lot of things. But one of the things that really concerns me, I don't care about HBO and Showtime. I don't even pay for that stuff now. Even if it were free, I wouldn't watch it. There's a lot of junk out there. But one of the big concerns I have is accessing information from other people, maybe around the world or even within my local community, about issues that are going on. So the Internet has done a great job of connecting us and allowing us to have access to information from each other rather than from, let's say just our legislators or our other politicians. So my concerns have to do with freedom of speech, of access to information, you know, right to assemble, you know, how is that going to impact, let's say, if Comcast is my provider and they got people on the board of directors or their shareholders who don't have the same political views I do, right? And I'm trying to access, say, a website or a news site that maybe goes against maybe what their majority of their shareholders appreciate, my content's going to be slowed down or potentially, or I have to pay more. Now, let's say I'm somebody with a low economic standing and I can't afford to access that. It becomes an issue of inequality in a big way, I think. And I haven't heard that discussion yet, and maybe that's not most important to people, but for me, that's huge.
Well, thanks, Jody. April Glazer.
So, you know, it's hard to say what's going to happen, and it would be a stretch to say that, you know, any internet service provider would make an ideological decision like that. But looking at what's happened in other countries in terms of blocking, you know, our ability to communicate, you know, in Morocco in 2016, multiple internet providers agreed together, like this collusion idea, to block voiceover internet services like Skype and WhatsApp. And that was potentially in an effort to push people to subscribe to their phone plans, right? And people protested this, and then they went back on that. You know, we did see a more ideological type of blocking in 2015. which was in Canada, a telecom called TELUS, blocked access to a union website that was promoting a labor strike against the internet company. So, you know, we have seen these types of games played before. I think that's less likely in the U.S. case, but it's happened before, and we just don't know what's going to happen next.
And again, April Glazer is a technology writer for Slate. We're also joined by Brian Fung, technology writer for The Washington Post. And let's go next to Hunter in San Mateo. Hi, Hunter.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much for the conversation. This is awesome. I live and work in Silicon Valley. Full disclosure, I totally agree that repealing net neutrality, or rather I believe, is a bad move. However, similar to one of the comments that was written, we do live in a society where we have the opportunity to charge more for certain services and give the consumers the ability to pay for different types of services. So I would love to hear more examples of what the panelists think could be possible with that sort of stuff, because I think there is another side of this coin. I do think that it's going to be ultimately worse for consumers overall, but I am curious to hear some of the thoughts that could happen.
You mean the potential benefits of this decision, you mean?
Yes, absolutely. More, you know, innovative services provided by the ISPs, the content providers, you know, you can pay more to get more, pay less to get less. I think there are some benefits overall, not probably outweighing the cons, but I would love to hear more
sure.
of the supposed benefits. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Hunter. Brian Fung, do you want to start?
Sure. So there are a couple of concrete examples that we can look to as kind of precedents here without, you know, delving too much into speculation about what new business models we might see, since I think, you know, by definition, new business models would be kind of hard to predict. But, you know, a couple of things that have raised questions in the net neutrality context are, one, an effort or an experiment at one point by AT&T to offer discounts on internet service in exchange for letting it essentially scoop up or mine your web browsing history and other internet usage data for advertising purposes. So that's one example. Another example is this rating, which you may have heard about. And zero rating is this practice, you know, where a wireless provider like T-Mobile or Sprint or AT&T says, okay, if you want to stream Netflix or listen to Spotify, you can listen to that content or watch that content, and it won't affect your data cap. This is, you know, potentially something that's good for consumers in that it allows them to stretch their data plans farther. But, you know, it raised questions at the FCC about whether or not it was potentially anti-competitive because in a report, the FCC said companies like Verizon were favoring their own proprietary video apps, an app called Go90, that could potentially come at the expense of other newer startups and video providers that wanted to offer streaming video over the internet. That's something else that you know, won't be going away in a world where it's legal for internet providers to favor affiliated content providers.
Yes, you're reminding me of just how complicated the world is out there, because one of the earlier questions we got from a listener, April Glazer, was could Google, you know, do something around this, right? And they're both a content provider, but they also have Google Fiber, right, for example. So you have like these ISPs that are also producing content. I mean, does that make them more or less sympathetic to, you know, net neutrality?
It probably makes them less sympathetic to net neutrality because, you know, for instance, we have AT&T with a bid to buy Time Warner, and Time Warner owns HBO, right? And, you know, you could imagine a world in which if you are a subscriber to AT&T, you get free HBO, and maybe you love that. As the previous caller said, that's a good thing because you want HBO. But that isn't really a neutral practice because, you know, then Verizon you know, subscribers would get slower access to HBO, and so they'll move to AT&T. And we might just see these large conglomerates kind of controlling what we see and where we go to spend our money.
Well, this listener writes, can the state of California refuse to do business with ISPs who do not honor net neutrality? A related tweet says, are there workarounds for local towns, cities, and states? Could there be public and open taxpayer-funded ISPs? And this gets earlier to, we played in our billboard a clip from Senator Scott Wiener, who has promised to introduce legislation that would try to adopt net neutrality in the state of California. Can he do that? Do FCC rules allow that? April Glazer.
The new rules actually preempt the ability for states to create their own net neutrality laws because, ostensibly the internet is kind of an interstate service, and to create kind of a balkanized internet where some states have some rules and other states have no rules, the FCC has attempted to preempt that might also be challenged. But the other half of that, which is, should municipalities or local governments be able to create kind of their own ISP or their own broadband provider is a really good question, because the more choices consumers have, and the more places they can go. So if the city of San Francisco was to create its own ISP that didn't act in a discriminatory way, we could imagine consumers voting with their wallet and going there instead.
Well, again, if you want to join this conversation on net neutrality and what the repeal of net neutrality could mean, how it could play out, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, email us, forum@kqed.org, or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me go next to James in Dublin. Hi, James.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
So a huge red flag for me in this that I haven't heard anyone talking about is that this is happening alongside the rise of cryptocurrency, which is hugely volatile in value right now. It swings massive percentages on a day-to-day basis. If ISPs can have de facto control over access and speed of different sorts of websites, they can indirectly control the value of these cryptocurrencies.
Hmm. Well, Brian Fung, what do you think?
I think that's plausible, certainly there's a lot of interest in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies right now. Mainly the interest has been in the value or the price of these cryptocurrencies, but you also have a tremendous amount of interest in these technologies, the underlying technology, the blockchain, as something that could become a fundamental network, you could say, for all kinds of transactions, whether that's trading of real estate titles or executing of contracts and things like that. And so the idea that internet providers could effectively guide the development of this new form of economic transaction sort of processing network it's potentially very dramatic for the future of the global economy.
Well, here's another pricing related question from Will. Can you explain how website-based pricing might work when more than one ISP is involved in a transmission? For example, if my ISP is company X and the ISP serving the website I'm accessing is company Y, and maybe there's a company Z between them, all with different pricing, who pays what to whom? April Glazer, thoughts?
Again, it's really hard to say how this is going to play out once the rules hit the books. That said, we could imagine where a scenario wherein a website has to pay every single ISP to reach their subscribers, right? So if you're Facebook, you might strike a deal with Comcast. So Comcast users get faster access to Facebook. You might not strike the same deal with Verizon, and they might have a different type of connectivity to you. But, it's going to be hard to say until we see how this plays out.
Well, let's go next to Jim in San Jose. Hi, Jim.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah. So I had a comment too about I work at home a lot. I work for a tech company in San Jose, and a lot of my infrastructure is different places around the world. And I've actually faced problems with Comcast, who is the only high speed provider in my neighborhood. That where packets going like across the world, get routed in funny ways such that it takes a lot longer. We've had problems with VPN connections, and we've also mentioned earlier, issues with VoIP or voice over IP kind of connections, where the bandwidth, they can guarantee you 20 megabits per second, but if they route the packets in funny ways, you don't get a consistent quality of service, then your voice breaks up, the video isn't smooth, and that kind of thing is very hard to detect as a consumer. It requires very sophisticated kinds of, probing of their network. And I'm really concerned about net neutrality in that way, that we need to have a consistent quality of service. And I'm in a place, again, I'm in the middle of Silicon Valley. I have one provider. There is no choice.
Jim, thanks for registering that point. John tweets, why aren't we going after local governments that have granted local cable and telco monopolies to the detriment of their constituents? We'd have choices for broadband if our local governments hadn't outlawed competition for the first mile. And let me hear now from Michelle in Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern is I am both a librarian and an elected official in a small town in northern Michigan. And my worry is from the, not the consumer side, but as the provider of information, my worry is as a single ISPN town, that the ISBN will just, ISP, sorry, that's a library term, but ISP will just keep jacking up my prices, and I have to have my public information available.
Michelle, I think we're getting the point. I think your call may have dropped out there. But, you know, a lot of this is underscoring the concerns with competition, Brian Fung, in this space. If you were to, I don't know, look in your crystal ball, would you say that this decision by the FCC will actually make things better in smaller rural areas or smaller towns like Michelle from Traverse City?
Well, that's the argument that a lot of folks who are in favor of the FCC have pointed out, that this could potentially incentivize ISPs to invest in their broadband networks and make particularly rural areas better off. That said, nothing has really prevented ISPs from investing in those areas, to date. And so the question is, why haven't we seen more investment in rural areas and parts of in underserved parts of America? And a lot of folks point out that these areas just don't have the population density to support the type of investment that internet providers kind of want or would want to see as far as returns on investment, which kind of gets us back to this point about individual cities and towns trying to build their own alternatives. You have places like Chattanooga in Tennessee or Wilson, North Carolina, building their own fiber optic networks, and in some cases they're really great. You can get a gigabit per second connection from Chattanooga for about $70 a month, but in a lot of cases you have large incumbent telecom and cable providers who've actively sought to block cities and states from building out their own networks. And you see state legislatures who are also doing the same thing, in part due to pressure by large incumbents as well. And so, it's not so simple to say, given the FCC's decision, that states and cities could build their own, when there's a lot of inertia pushing back against it.
Well, Sam writes, is there a way to make a freedom of speech challenge to the repeal of net neutrality? Sort of touched on this before within a comment earlier from Jody, but what do you think, April Glazer?
I think that there are a lot of challenges that could be made. And we really have to see what these ISPs do before we make those challenges. That said, if Verizon or AT&T does something as so brazen as to block, what people are saying because of what they're saying, then sure. But that said, if people are able to make a case that they're unable to speak freely because their connection to subscribers is sufficiently slowed down, we could see those types of challenges emerge.
Yes, but that's like a brazen act. Yes, Brian Funk.
Yeah, so the First Amendment question here is really interesting, right? Because you have, on the one hand, this argument that April was explaining, which is that individual consumers' voices could be harmed as a result of this. But then you'll expect to see, and in fact, this is an argument that the industry has already made before a court, that the rules that were put in place in 2015 were themselves of First Amendment violation, because it represented a government trying to sanction the voice of a private actor, in this case, you know, companies such as AT&T or Verizon. And so, you know, if we do see the First Amendment question raised in court, you'll have essentially dueling arguments on this constitutional issue.
Yes, that's why the language on both sides is that net neutrality repeal made everything freer and net neutrality made everything freer. So they're invoking both of it. But as we were talking about in terms of these types of brazen actions, right, that you could report to the FTC or whatever, it's not like it's likely to happen, right? I mean, it's not like these ISPs are likely to do anything so dramatic that that it would get people up in arms very quickly.
Right. I think that the way ISPs will act without net neutrality is going to be more like a death by a thousand cuts rather than, you know, these large sweeping silencing things that people are really afraid of. You know, I think it's more likely that you're to notice that your website is loading slower, so you navigate to another tab, or all of a sudden you get free access without counting against your data caps to stream Netflix on your phone, and you might like that. And, you know, before you know it, you're using the internet in a lot less diverse ways, and before you know it, you know, the internet is a much more boring place.
So we're hearing, Brian Fung, that this could go through the courts. Ultimately, we started the conversation talking about Congress. Is that where any kind of long-term lawmaking needs to occur to end any back and forth in the space? What I'm thinking of is if, for example, there's a change in administration or a change in the makeup of Congress, right, we could have this kind of flip back. But the flipping back and forth, I'm sure, isn't healthy for anybody. So do you think that there's anything there on that level, at the congressional level, given the lack of popularity of this decision?
This is something that I actually wrote about today with, you know, this constant back and forth that, you know, a lot of folks probably don't realize has been going on almost since, you know, the dot-com boom itself. So, you know, a lot of folks have pointed out that Congress is the only venue where this could realistically be solved. Otherwise, you know, you're just going to keep seeing one FCC trying to overturn the prior FCC's decision over and over and over again. To some extent, I think that's probably, you know, politically and tactically the case. But realistically, the fact that, you know, you kind of need enough votes to drum up bipartisan legislation is going to be really difficult at a time when the country and Congress is really, really polarized. So I think at this point, things are going to take just a long time probably to sort out.
Well, Brian Fung is technology reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for talking with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks also to April Glazer, technology writer for Slate.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank Congresswoman Anna Eshoo and Chris Kelly, chairman of Fandor, for joining us earlier in the hour. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer today is Jeremy Siegel, with online support from Amanda Font. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.